Okay, here we go. A United Nations climate panel warns in a new report last week that humanity has only about a dozen years to mitigate climate change or face global catastrophe with severe droughts, floods, sea level rise, and extreme heat set to cause mass displacement and poverty. The landmark report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, warns dramatic action is needed over the next 12 years to hold global temperature rise below 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. So to discuss this report and much more, I'm pleased to be joined by Chris Turner. As I said, he's one of Canada's leading voices on climate change solutions. He's also the author of several books, including The Geography of Hope, A Tour of the World We Need, The Leap, How to Survive and Thrive in the Sustainable Economy, and The Patch, The People, Pipelines, and Politics of the Oil Sands, which won this year's National Business Book Award. So welcome to Earth Gauge Radio, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So given the IPCC's report last week, their urgent warning to humanity, I want to ask you off the top here, do you think Canada, under the current Liberal government, is doing enough to reduce our country's carbon emissions?
Well, I mean, it's easy to say they're not doing enough because nobody's doing enough. And that was the message of the IPCC, and it's been a message that's been pretty consistent from the scientific community and a number of other fronts for a long time. I think the more pertinent question and the thing that I tried to address in the Globe piece is, are they doing pretty close to everything they can given the political realities that they have to face? And I, on that front, I would say, you know, they're pretty close to the mark. This is a really, really complicated, often very unpopular bunch of policy things that need to happen in order to begin to sort of start the emissions trajectory downward. And I think you look at the degree of pushback already on what lots of people, you know, certainly lots of scientists, some of their opposition in the environmental community and on the left would say is nowhere near enough. But even those you know, modest efforts, if you want to call them that, you look at the amount of pushback and the case that certainly, you know, you would hear Liberal cabinet ministers make, which is this is as fast as we can get this thing moving from basically the standstill it was at when we came in. I mean, there's a pretty strong, a lot of, you know, evidence to support the fact that that's a fair assessment, that they've pushed as hard and fast as they can to date, and, you know, their intention is to continue to do so, but that it's a very difficult thing to get everything moving, particularly in a federation like Canada's where you know, energy policy is not controlled by the federal government.
That's right, it's provincial. And you make that point in the article that there's good climate policy and there's great climate policy, and you know, if I'm quoting you correctly, that you're saying that Canada does have, in fact, good climate policy, but is it enough? You know, the Climate Action Now, that organization has calculated Canada's emissions need to actually fall to 385 megatons by 2030, which is 55% below 2010 and much lower than Canada's current target. And that is, in fact, what the IPCC report is calling for. So given you just alluded to, you know, getting policy implemented and the difficulties in Canada, is this even remotely possible?
Well, I think it's we can't say what's possible 12 years from now because we can't say what's possible past the next election. And I think that's the reality for politicians, not just in Canada but worldwide, is, you know, everyone understands there are, you know, or, you know, most of the world now understands that there's a lot that needs to be done, but they also have to deal with the fact that, you know, you can put fantastic policies that you know, absolutely begin to move toward the trajectory of a Paris target. You can put them in place tomorrow, and if you're out of office the day after that, and all of that is reversed, which we're seeing a bit of in Canada already with, you know, Doug Ford in Ontario, mm-hmm. the possibility of a Jason Kenney government here in Alberta, where I live, that's the reality that they're facing. So I would say, you know, rather than to be, you know, as fair as possible to the people doing this work, you know, who I believe are working, you know, in good faith and as hard as they can, I think what we need to look at is how, you know, are the actions we're taking right now able to begin a process that can then be accelerated. And I don't think that that's just, you know, letting them off the hook. I think it's fair to say, and you look at countries that have made really great progress on climate change, and this has been the case, you get the ball rolling and you don't just explode out of the gate immediately on target. because the shock to political systems, social systems, economic systems is just too great. Can you get things moving hard enough in the right direction that they begin to create their own kind of momentum? I think that's, you know, for whatever, you know, better or worse, that's what our government's trying to do, and a number of governments around the world are trying to do. And we can look at that and say, well, that's not going to hit your Paris targets. The IPCC says that's not enough. And my counter-argument, which I make in the Globe, is it's certainly better than not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So if we can only do this much so far, let's do that and keep pushing to do more. But there's this tendency, I think largely for political reasons, to sort of look at whatever is currently happening and say that's not good enough or that's too much or whatever, and just use it because it is a very, very effective political tool to say, you know, on the right of the federal liberals, for example, this is costing us way too much and it doesn't matter. The United States isn't doing anything. China is still burning coal at a record rate. Why are we shooting ourselves in the foot when no one else is trying? That's easy political hay for them to make. And then on the left, you can kind of say, you know, well, none of this is sufficient enough, and you're not, significantly, closing up shop on the oil sands or anything right. like that. You're not really doing anything serious. You need, this is all just window dressing for business as usual. And both of those arguments are really, effective political arguments. I don't think either of them get us any closer to the target than what we're currently doing. It's just the easy political shots.
Easy politics, yeah. And you kind of conclude with this, a dire statement that because of this, these competing narratives, that we're stuck in the mire of this issue, and we may in fact lose 10 years because of our focus on the Kinder Morgan pipeline and this, what you call the failed Trudeau-Notley consensus over, the federal Liberal Burger.
I'd say it's actually in danger of failing. I don't think it's failed yet.
The
framework's still in place. The federal carbon price backstop is still happening. So whether, at least as long as we have the current federal government, there will be a national price on carbon. That's not nothing. The national coal phase out, that was like Saskatchewan has been dragging its feet on that anyway. I think it'll probably continue in Alberta, even if the government changes here. So it's not that nothing will happen. Mm-hmm. It's just the bigger worry is there was actually a really unique and powerful thing that happened in 2016 was that you had coordination among virtually every single government in Canada other than Saskatchewan. Which is unprecedented. I mean, mainly because Alberta has never had a government that's been willing to go along on any of this stuff yeah. with what the feds or anyone else wants to do. And that got churned up in this pipeline debate, in some of the larger questions about, like, are we really doing enough and the rest of it. And I understand. I mean, there were certainly arguments to be made against the Trans Mountain Pipeline that were legitimate arguments. The climate argument, to my mind, never held a lot of water. It's not the reason why the Federal Court of Appeal quashed the approval. They did that for reasons of yeah. First Nations land rights and coastal protection. So, and the concern is that consensus, which was a pretty rare thing and really got some great stuff in place, is going to be thrown out along with this this larger political mess.
Yeah, but absolutely. So I'm wondering then is if this focus on the pipeline has distracted Canadians. You say that it's not going to make that much difference in terms of Canada's emissions, but we know that oil sands emissions are slated to, in fact, increase by 40% by 2030 when we need to be going in the opposite direction. And that pipeline seems to facilitate that increase in production. But you seem to say in your article that this has been kind of a distraction, this focus on the pipeline.
Yeah, well, I mean, for one thing, what you want, the best you could do under the current political reality is what's there, which is a hard cap on emissions from the oil sands. It's not great. It's far from perfect, but it was what by far the most left-wing government in Alberta history decided they could manage and not have and get the kind of buy-in that they needed to actually be able to get moving on it.
Right, but it's a hard cap that allows for an increase of, as I say, 40%.
It does allow for continued increase, and that is that's the same as you look at every single serious climate policy package anywhere on Earth, and they put protections in place for what they call, I forget the phrase, something like trade-facing or trade-exposed industries. So anything that trades in an open an international marketplace. In Scandinavia, it's things like aluminum and things like that, you know, that where you know we realized if we brought in our full carbon price on this particular industry, it would collapse it overnight, and we don't want to do that because that'll kind of get in the way of where we're trying to get. So we give sort of special dispensations for those. So that's not. Rarity. The other thing I would say is that the idea that one of the things that got really, I think, kind of badly translated in this pipeline debate is the idea that pipelines drive oil sands production, where in oil production generally they don't. Do they sometimes lead to increased production? Do they certainly help facilitate? Sure, but the price of oil mainly does that, and the profit margins and the rest of it. Mm-hmm. So the idea that the Trans Mountain pipeline, in and of itself, regardless of other conditions going on, was going to create X percent increase in production over any particular length of time is just pure speculation. There's no hard numbers. And under the current market realities, odds are no one's investing big money in serious expansion of the oil sands at this point anyway.
Right.
Canada got beaten badly to market by fracked oil in the United States. While we've been having this, very, very intense debate here in Canada about what to do with the oil sands, which is 3 million barrels of oil a day, the U.S. has added almost 7 million barrels a day of fracked oil, mm-hmm. which, yes, is marginally less dirty at the production level, but it's just as dirty at the tailpipe. So.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so I'd like to get into, shift away from pipelines here and talk about carbon pricing policy a little bit, which you discuss in your article, and the difficulty in implementing even a modest carbon price in Canada. Now, economists across the political spectrum have been calling for a carbon price for some time as a simple and effective way of dealing with this problem. I want to ask you first, you seem to suggest that maybe perhaps Canadians don't fully understand what carbon tax or carbon pricing is. Can you just give us a sense of when the Liberals talk about a carbon price or a carbon tax, what is it exactly?
Well, so what they have said is that the federal government is going to backstop whatever the provinces do. And the provinces have done a mix of things, the two big ones being a direct tax, which is basically you emit a ton of carbon, this is how much you pay the provincial government for it. $30 in the case of BC. Alberta's, I think, started at 20 and is supposed to ramp up toward 50, which is the how the federal one has been designed. Mm-hmm. And then there are cap and trade systems where the carbon credits trade on the open market, and that determines like a stock market determines what the price on carbon is. And Ontario and Quebec, for example, were in a cap and trade market. I'm trying to remember, California I think was in the same market with
right.
them. There were some others.
Yeah.
The Ontario government pulled out of that unilaterally. I saw a thing just this morning saying that the Ontario government estimates it's going to cost them $3 billion
yeah.
in revenue doing that. So that was, incredibly stupid on several fronts.
Yeah.
But basically the idea and why economists like it is rather than trying to, basically what the Harper government, for example, claimed it was going to do but never got around to doing, is go sector by sector and say, okay, steel producers are going to deal with carbon emissions this way, oil sands is going to deal with it this way, natural gas is going to deal with it this way. That's cumbersome. It's difficult to do. How do you set the prices or various other penalties? It all gets very expensive and complicated. Carbon price just says we don't want these emissions, and so if you do them, this is what it's going to cost you. And it has the added advantage of you can take that revenue and give it back to people, either by cutting other of their taxes, by investing in other stuff that they want, whatever else. So it's from an economist's point of view, it's a very simple, clear, elegant kind of thing to do. It costs virtually nothing to administer.
Right.
In the places where it's been tried, it's been fairly effective, certainly more effective than much more complicated schemes and actually beginning to reduce emissions. We see that in British Columbia, which has had a carbon tax for 10 years, where emissions are down, per capita fuel use is down. It gives a very clear price signal, which people react to. We all know this, that mm-hmm. You think more carefully about getting in your car and driving a long distance if gas prices are high.
Right.
It's just how it goes. We know that this thing is an effective way to do things. The difficulty is that because because climate change itself is kind of a giant unknown, because the carbon price or carbon tax is new, it's very easy to just characterize it as, oh, the government's coming to take more of your money.
Yeah.
And it winds up getting, it's a very difficult thing to sell to people.
Right.
Who don't understand. Although, I point this out in the piece in the Globe, British Columbia has had one for 10 years. And when they pulled British Columbians, when they did this just after, I think it was just after the Horgan government came in, because basically the previous government had not continued to increase it. They'd kind of put a moratorium on increasing the carbon tax, but left it in place. The majority of people in British Columbia could not say for sure whether or not there was a price on carbon in BC. That's how painful it was.
Yeah.
That, you know, the majority of people didn't even know if it was there or not.
Right, and so you say that's an example of good policy. And so despite that, though, now we're seeing increasing numbers of provinces, provincial premiers turning against this. We've got Manitoba is the latest to say they're going to fight the carbon tax, and we know Doug Ford is opposed, and if Jason Kenney is elected in Alberta, he's going to oppose the carbon tax. So despite these, you know, these IPCC warnings, we're hearing warning after warning from scientists, humanity seems to have basically failed in rising to the climate change challenge, and Canada is no exception. Why is it so difficult to take even modest action, such as introducing a carbon tax in Canada?
I think there's a whole pile of reasons for that, but I have an old friend and colleague named George Marshall, very, very smart guy, who spent most of his time thinking about the psychology of climate change and why he began from the point of view of why is it that, you know, those of us engaged in creating momentum and urgency around this are so engaged by it, and the majority of people don't feel that sense of urgency at all. And where he kind of came around to, and there is now quite a large and growing body of psychological and social, sort of science evidence backing this up, is that climate change just doesn't work the way a lot of other of these sorts of problems work. You look at the plastic straws, which have suddenly become this urgent issue,
yeah,
are a great example. You can see the problem. You know exactly when you're doing it, when you're using a straw, and when you're not. There is an immediate, obvious substitute, something not made of plastic, or just not using a straw, which is, for most people is not that big a sacrifice. And you can see the damage right away. Like, these things go right into the ocean, and then it's bad for marine life. Whereas climate change has none of that clarity. The feedback mechanisms from a kind of human psychology point of view are terrible. So we could put in, a $5,000 a ton carbon price, which is like one of the, so there's some number crunching in that IPCC report saying that's actually how big a carbon price we would need worldwide to turn the corner quick enough to stay under 1.5 degrees Celsius. We in Canada could do that and see virtually no benefit in any immediate sense. We would, it wouldn't immediately force the rest of the world to cut their carbon emissions. It wouldn't make, storms less intense as they kind of come in off the Atlantic and hit the Florida coast.
Yeah.
You don't get any of so because of that, and because we're also dealing with a thing that's not, hey, you used a straw, that's dumb. It's what you do every day. It's how you get around. It's how you heat your house.
Right.
So the complexity of it is overwhelming for people.
Yeah.
The feedback mechanism is not great, so you don't ever see direct benefit of that. And that's part of the reason why economists and some politicians like carbon prices, because it sends a clearer feedback. So the reason you're changing your behavior is not to save the world, but to save money, to not spend as much money on fuel. And that's not a bad way to kind of artificially send the signal we're going to, do less of this bad thing and more of some good things. Unfortunately, it involves politicians having to stand up and say, I want to tax you more. And that's such a difficult sell that obviously, as soon as there was, as soon as Doug Ford came in and said, I'm canceling the carbon price, all these other, premiers who didn't want to have to try and defend it next time they went to their electorate jumped right in and said, yeah, me neither. And it's, that is understandable. And when you look, I talk about this in the piece, like, there is, we can point to other places in the world, parts of Northern Europe have done an amazing job on this. Costa Rica's got 100% renewable on their grid. And when you look closely at any of those, everyone has done the easy stuff, and almost no one has touched the hard stuff. And I use the example of Germany, which I've written about extensively. Yes, Germany has done some amazing stuff to industrialize the renewable energy industry. Their grid is now, 30% plus green, and it began at less than 5%. But Germany also phased out nuclear instead of coal because basically because the Angela Merkel's government didn't want to lose their jobs.
Yeah.
So no one's got this licked. It's a very, very complicated thing to deal with.
Sure is, yeah. And I noticed in the States that some conservative politicians supporting a carbon tax are actually calling it a carbon dividend instead of a carbon dividend instead of a carbon tax to try to make it more palatable to people. I know you only have a minute left here, Chris, I just want to finish by asking you, what do you think is the way forward here for Canada?
I mean, I think, Canadians, if they really want to see climate action, really need to hand the politicians that they want to do this stuff the political. Politicians are not, can't generate their own political will. We're not, this is not an episode of The West Wing where a really great speech is going to make everyone do the thing. So what they hear is people don't want this, they don't care enough about it, it's not a big enough issue. And I think that needs to be targeted. I think if there was, you're never going to get as much, you're not going to get people marching in the street for a carbon tax the way you get people marching in the street to stop a pipeline. But if that message were a little bit unified, hey, we want a price on carbon, we are, willing to punish politicians who don't do it, we are willing to, help in the same way you look at, the information network on pipelines was not done top down. It was a bottom up kind of thing, and it became this top line issue for environmental groups across the country and around the world from the bottom up. If you had a similar kind of push toward what we want, which is a price on carbon and more investment in renewable energy and all the stuff that the Pan-Canadian framework that all the provinces agreed to in 2016 is doing. It might make it a lot easier for them to stand behind a carbon price. Right now, there's no cost to dumping it that anyone can see, and very, very little political gain to supporting it.
Right.
And to be honest, I would say this is where I do give Trudeau and his government credit. They know they are burning political capital on this thing, and they do actually believe in it hard enough that they are not going to. They will fight an election on it if they have to.
Yeah. Great. Well, I know you got to go, so thanks so much, Chris. I've been speaking with Chris Turner. He's one of Canada's leading voices on climate change solutions and the global energy transition, author of several books, including The Geography of Hope, The Leap, and The Patch. Thanks, Chris, for joining me today on EarthGauge Radio.
Happy to join you. Thanks for having me.